Lots to talk about for the next couple hours with Richard Smalley, of course. We're going to talk about one of his first books called Supernatural, also his other book that just came out called How God Became God. Pretty controversial. Richard is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Smalley back with us. Highly regarded. He is a graduate of Harvard College and the University of Oxford, longtime editor at the Spiritual Journey Gnosis, and the author of several books, including Supernatural and, of course, How God Became God. Richard Smalley on Coast to Coast. Richard, good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Great subjects that you have touched on. Definitely we'll spend some time talking about what I think is somewhat controversial, your book about how God became God. What's the reaction been to it?
Well, most people have been favorable toward it. I mean, you can look at the reviews on Amazon. There's some occasional discomfort with it. But generally, I've been very pleased with the response.
Good. We'll get into that. And a couple of our dear guests, Evan Alexander and Larry Dossey, have written very favorable remarks about your work. So,
Yes. I know them both, and I'm very appreciative of their kind comments.
Tell me how you got involved in this. In one of your first books was called Supernatural. Tell me how you got involved in that.
Well, I'd always been interested in mysticism and spirituality. My father had a very strong interest in it. He had been in the Navy a long time ago, like before the Second World War. And he said that he saw in various places, ranging from China to pretty much anywhere else, that he just saw things that he couldn't understand or explain. So he's had an interest in the paranormal. And he had books lying around about subjects like Edgar Cayce and flying saucers. And this was the mid-60s I'm talking about. I was about 10 years old, and I read some of them. So my interest started there, and later on, particularly toward the end of my formal education, I became drawn to studying spiritual traditions a little bit more directly and personally.
I just love the material. I mean, just it makes your mind wander, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. It is mind-blowing stuff, and there's always further to go with it. So if you think you know everything, you're probably wrong.
Exactly. Let's talk this half hour about some of the supernatural work you've done, and then we'll get into your latest work, How God Became God. Mm-hmm. And then we'll take calls in the second hour with you from so many people who are just fascinated in all these kinds of subjects. You have touched on a lot of topics, including Atlantis, mm-hmm. and you've got your own take on this. Tell us about that.
Well, let's go back to the basic source on Atlantis, which is the first source, which is the writings of Plato,
mm-hmm.
Around 360 BC. He wrote a couple of dialogues called the Timaeus and the Critias, and these contain the first stories of Atlantis. And in this, an Egyptian priest tells Solon, who is an ancestor of Plato, "You Greeks are children, because you know of only one flood only." The Greeks had a flood myth like the one in the Bible. But there have been many destructions of humanity, both by fire and water. And we have records of these. And these records go back very, very far. Now, the record included a description of Atlantis, which this priest told Solon was submerged around 9600 BC. It was 9,000 years before Solon's time, which was 600 BC. So we're getting very close to 10,000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is very interesting because this is around the time of the end of the last ice age. And we know quite clearly from completely conventional sources that there was a lot of land that was above water that was submerged at that time. So when one thing, this doesn't prove the story of Atlantis, but it does say that there's nothing scientifically improbable about it. And it does fit in with what we know of the geological record.
I mean, something clearly happened to a landmass a long time ago.
Yeah, and there's no reason to believe that there wasn't an advanced civilization that was caught up in this. Now, no one has found this. Plato said it was beyond the Straits of Gibraltar, which would put it somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean.
Richard, speak up a little bit more.
I'm sorry. Plato said it was in the Atlantic Ocean, outside the Straits of Gibraltar. Now, there's a very interesting detail in Plato's description, which leads one to think it might be more than a myth. One thing he says about Atlantis is Atlantis is a gateway to the vast and immeasurable continent beyond. That is to say, there was some tradition of the existence of the Americas in Plato's time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's all it says. But it is striking that, yeah, they obviously knew something about this and that there may be more to this than meets the eye. So I think there is a germ of historical truth in the Atlantis story. Now, Plato's version is strongly allegorical, and he says that actually the Athenians, Plato was an Athenian, fought the people of Atlantis way back when and won. But nevertheless, I think it's fairly clear that there is a germ of truth to the story. I have also heard it said, well, Aristotle, Plato's pupil, one of the smartest men who ever lived, makes a remark in one of his books that says the waters beyond the Straits of the Gibraltar were not navigable in his day. Aristotle lived, a generation later.
Too treacherous for the kinds of ships they had, maybe?
Well, yeah, but that would mean the waters were shallow.
Ah, okay.
So it may mean the sea levels in that area were different and maybe higher than they are today, when the Straits of Gibraltar, I'm talking about the Atlantic beyond the Straits,
mm-hmm.
are perfectly navigable. So all of these point to the existence of some kind of change, possibly in, the Atlantic Ocean just off of Spain. We have to take this seriously. Now, I haven't seen any archaeological discoveries that suggest that anyone has found this, but that doesn't really mean anything. There are enormous numbers of things in the ocean that we know nothing about and haven't been found.
Is there anything, Richard, written that describes the kind of technology they did have?
Well, they apparently did have a certain amount of sophisticated. They were able to dredge the sea. Let me see if I can pull this up. Let's see. I'm trying to see if I can pull this up online.
Well, that's right. If you can't, then don't worry about that. But, I mean, I've always heard that they had some kind of incredible technology. And why would they be the ones to get, wiped out than some other civilization that had nothing? So I'm wondering if the technology had something to do with their demise.
Well, now we get into more esoteric and occult theories. Now, one very common esoteric theory propounded by H.P. Blavatsky, among other people, was that the Atlanteans misused certain powers. Now, these powers are usually described as more or less like occult powers rather than technological powers per se. So, and I think we have to at least consider this as a possibility, because technology is not always what we think it is. We think of it in terms of smartphones and automobiles and that sort of thing. But if you look at civilizations like the Tibetan Buddhists or some indigenous cultures, their technologies are extremely primitive, but their capacities for developing and possessing extrasensory powers are probably much more advanced than ours. They had their spiritual, or shall we say, psychological technology is far ahead of our own. So it may be that Atlantis, whatever it was, had perfected these arts to a very high degree. Now, hey, guess what? If this is true, it would be very difficult to find any major structures or buildings or whatever, because their technology was, shall we say, internal. And I have heard legends among the American Indians that have said that there were civilizations in this case in the Americas that destroyed themselves by magical wars of sorcery, that kind of thing. Now then you could say, well, speculating further, did this have to do something to do with the fact that Atlantis was submerged? As I say, the occult theorists often say yes.
Would you consider yourself a skeptic with these subjects?
I have a very firm rule that has done me an enormous amount of good over the years with a lot of this stuff, with a lot of all sorts of stuff. I was taught it a long time ago. Neither accept nor reject. If you can hold these ideas in your mind and contemplate them and think, well, yeah, they might well be true. I have no necessarily reason to believe that they're true. I don't have any reason necessarily to believe they're not true. I can just hold these ideas in my mind. That in itself is psychologically, and I would say spiritually, liberating. Because if you start going through, like, well, do I believe this? I believe this. Soon you start to drive yourself nuts.
Yeah, that's true.
And I say this not only about this kind of paranormal sort of fringe phenomena, but almost everything else, because we actually know very little about the world. Everything from politics, religion, environment. We know some things, but we personally know very little. And it's always a good idea to contemplate possibilities and think about possibilities, often without taking too serious a decision about them.
In the book Supernatural, you talk about occult occurrences, demonic possessions, and are these people who are truly possessed, or are they mentally ill and something just has happened to them?
Well, my view is that there are some cases of each, that there are some cases, where people are hearing voices and, they give them medicine for schizophrenia and they calm right down. In other cases, it looks more like what we would call possession or intrusion by an alien spirit. And some psychologists, including C.G. Jung, who's one of the most celebrated psychologists of the 20th century, said that, sometimes the spirit possession theory works as well or better than any other. But I would add one thing very quickly. I'm increasingly convinced of this, that, that many, 99% of these demons are in some way or another self-created.
By the individual.
Not necessarily consciously. Maybe there is a part of the mind that may split off and start to act independently, as you see in multiple personality disorder. But there may be even more extreme versions of that when it actually turns into a sort of invisible entity that torments the individual, because the individual created it. It's essentially his problem, and under most circumstances, it's not going to bother anybody else.
Well, if these are happening, even if one case is real, How do you explain that? What's going on?
There are entities in unseen worlds that exist and interact with us whether we want to believe it or not. I'm fairly convinced that's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the evidence, you know, throughout human history is just too vast to say anything else. And the supposedly rational or scientific explanations really don't explain very much at all. If you look at them seriously in terms of actual phenomena, they start to look very much like special pleading. Like, you know, for example, every horror movie you've ever seen, right? Always, there's always like some scientist, you know, in the first like, you know, half hour or so, well, there's a rational explanation for this, I don't know, blah, 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 you know, and then, you know, it turns out that, you know, no, there's no rational explanation, you know, the scientist ends up having to believe along with everybody else in the movie. So I think this is a real thing. You know, I think there's serious problems with scientific materialism, you know, which is kind of a fake religion that, you know, has kind of made an idol of science or what it pretends to be science. And I think many people are outgrowing that, and it's probably time that society as a whole outgrows that.
Let's talk, Richard, for a moment about the people who believe in end time prophecy, and many believe we are in it right now. What's your take on that?
Well, I found a website not so long ago that had a list of the years in the last 2000 for which somebody had predicted that the world was going to end. And there were a lot of years in the last 2000 that were on that list. Some of them are more famous than others. And they didn't really come true.
We're still here.
We're still here. I think, yeah, it looks as if the scale of the universe is larger than ours. But there's another element to it. Because your world is going to end in a few decades at the most. So is mine. So is the world of every person who's listening to this, because that's just human life. So the end is coming for us individually. Now, I think much of the obsession with end times prophecies is what psychologists call a displacement. That is to say, you're going to die. That's just a fact. And this is a fact that most people don't want to face. So what you do is you kind of displace it on a further, more remote, less likely fear that you can handle. Now notice another thing about the end times. It happens to everybody at once, according to all of the mm-hmm. usual versions. And this is comforting, because the idea of dying is not pleasant. The idea of dying alone is that much less pleasant. So in many ways, I think the end time prophecies are attempts to deal with you know, people's own very real fears of death, and to make them collective. Now, there's another aspect to the question, which is that, in a sense, yes, it is the case that we're living in end times, because every age changes. Every age, in a sense, marks the end of a world.
Hold on, Richard. We're at the break. We're going to come back. We'll pick it up there. End times prophecy when we come back.
Don't forget to watch our TV show, Beyond Belief with George Norrie. Just log on to beyondbelief.com.
Okay, welcome back to Coast. Richard Smalley with us. His book, two of them out there, Supernatural, How God Became God. And Richard, let's talk a little bit more about these demons and end time prophecy. Then I want to get into your new work, How God Became God. That's fascinating too. But with some of these end times prophetic statements, every, as you mentioned, every civilization has had predictors claiming that they were in the end times. Every one, and none of them have come true. And that's the same with right now, right?
Yes, that's true. I mean, I spoke about people's fears about death being displaced onto the end times. But there's another aspect to the matter, which is that it is also true, for reasons we do not understand, each civilization has a period of birth, growth, maturity, decline, and death, just like a human being. And people in those civilizations have some idea that that's happening, and they may well sense, not always accurately, but they may sense that they're somewhere along some timeline for their own civilization. So, and it is the case, civilizations, you know, have lifespans just the way people do. As I said, we don't know why. I read any number of attempts at explaining it, but none of them were completely convincing. Also, unfortunately, when you're in the middle of it, you have no real way of knowing exactly where you are. So you can assume it's at the end. You can assume, you know, it greatly has to do with, almost the prevailing mood.
When one reads the Bible, specifically Genesis, you can come up with many interpretations. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it with an eye toward an extraterrestrial visitation or something like that, it kind of opens it up to a lot of different possibilities rather than just the biblical meaning of angels and falling and Lucifer and things like that. How do you approach that?
Well, I think the possibility of extraterrestrial contact has always been there. But as I said before the break, I do think there are unseen beings that also interact with us. Some of these seem friendlier and more helpful than others. Some of them seem sometimes kind of nasty. Some of them may look nasty. Now, if something, I mean, you have all those pictures of devils and whatnot, does that mean those creatures are bad? Because these people, these images do exist in people's minds.
Right, and they look bad.
They look bad. But on the other hand, you know, pick up a copy of National Geographic. There'll be some, feature about life at, you know, the bottom of the ocean. Most creatures look equally horrible, sometimes more horrible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Are they evil? No, they are just different. That doesn't mean to say that everything that looks ugly
is evil.
Is either friendly or evil. But I think that gives us a bit more perspective on it. There is obviously some truth to the notion of some kind of extraterrestrial contact with UFOs. I mentioned the psychologist C.G. Jung. He wrote a book about flying saucers about 60 years ago. And his verdict was, something is seen, one doesn't know what. And, you know, that's kind of about where we are, you know, almost a lifetime later. As far as Genesis is concerned, one thing to remember, I would strongly argue, is that Genesis, like the account of the fall, for example, is not literally true in the sense that God got mad at the human race for eating a piece of fruit in Armenia 6,000 years ago. But in another level, it's very true. And I'll tell you a story to illustrate it.
All right.
A man and a woman once came to God and said, "Hi, Lord, we've heard that there's this thing out there called good and evil. And we're kind of curious about it. We kind of like to find out what it is." And God says to them, "That is not a good idea. I do not recommend that you do that." And they said, "Oh, come on, we want to." And God said, "All right, that's what you want. But you're going to go down to a realm where you have to work hard for a living and where it hurts to have babies." And that is the myth of Adam and Eve. It's a statement of our condition. We, for metaphysical reasons that could become a very long discussion, we in the human race have chosen to come down into a world where we know good and evil. And I can say categorically about every person who listens to this, whoever will listen to this, you have experienced some good and some evil in your life. You have known both good and evil. And that is the, I would say, a much truer understanding of Genesis. And at that point, it's just simply the case. We do know good and evil. We do experience it. And that's kind of the way it is. Notice nobody says anything about hell. But I think that is a very important and it's in a way more true than if it were a real literal story about something that happened a few thousand years ago.
Does hell exist? I'm not sure it does.
Well, you have three possibilities with the afterlife. One is that there isn't one.
Right.
The other one is that you go, you come back here, life on Earth again.
Reincarnation. That's right. As Eben Alexander believes.
Yes, that's right. Or your third choice is that you go to a different realm, which may be better or may be worse than the one we're in now. And there you have the idea of heaven and hell. It does seem that there are states that are considerably less pleasant than this. One always has to say that, in many ways the most profound theologians, the Christian writer C.S. Lewis basically says something like this in his book, The Great Divorce. So did the great Swedish visionary Emanuel Swedenborg. In a sense, you're in hell because that's kind of where you're suited to. That's the kind of person you are. I draw an example. If you've ever been to for whatever reason, into an incredibly seedy, sleazy bar.
I've stumbled into a few of those with some buddies in my earlier days.
Yeah. Well, we all have for one reason or another. So, and they kind of look at it like, wow, well, this is an incredibly dismal place. Why would anyone want to be here? And yet there are people, no one has to be there. No one has to be chained to a bar.
But you're in there.
But you're in there. Because why? Because that's the kind of place you like.
It's like being in hell.
Yeah, and those places sometimes even do have a kind of hellish quality to them, even though, nobody's roasting on flames or anything like that.
That we know of, at least.
but anyway, that's, if you think of hell more in that sense, I think it's possible. Whether, people stay there eternally or whatever, I don't necessarily believe that. But I believe that there are different states and that I myself believe in an afterlife, and I believe that, the range of choices may be large. Some people may need to come back to Earth however many times. Other people don't need to come back or don't want to come back. They go on somewhere else. We know that life has an enormous number of potentialities, that is, life on Earth. So there's really every reason to believe that the afterlife has at least as many potentialities. So that's the way I see it.
Well, with Richard Smalley, his new book is called How God Became God. Let me ask you about the flood, and then we'll get into some other aspects of your new work.
Okay.
I have a difficult time comprehending that a God talked to a Noah, and he built an ark and got every animal duplicates on that thing, and they floated away for 40 days and 40 nights. I have a difficult time comprehending that. Am I alone with that or what?
No, you're not alone with that. And again, from a literal point of view, it's almost impossible to imagine, or it is impossible to imagine.
First of all, the ark was not big enough to accommodate every animal on this planet.
No.
Times two.
But I'll tell you something about the Ark, incidentally. The Jewish mystical tradition known as the Kabbalah has a great deal about sacred number and sacred proportion.
Right. And sacred geometry as well.
Yes. And the proportions of the Ark have to do with that. Now, a friend of mine actually worked this out in great detail. Unfortunately, he can't talk to you about it because he's dead. But, you know, he said it.
Well, on this show, he may be able to talk to us. You never know.
Well, if you know his number, we'll give him a ring.
That's right.
In any case, so I think, there are profound symbolic meanings to the flood. A spiritual meaning is that if you wish to progress spiritually, grow, you have to build an ark in yourself. That is to say, something in yourself that can float on the waters of the psyche. The waters are an almost universal symbol of the psyche, the mind in all its levels, conscious and unconscious. And there is something in yourself that has to be made that can float on this. And when the waters subside, it lands back on Earth and can bring forth a new existence for you. I believe, I mean, there's more to it than that, but I'm giving you a very capsule description of one spiritual interpretation of the ark. Now, to go to look at it from a more literal point of view, I certainly agree with what you said, but I would point out that one thing that is curious about the flood story is that almost alone among the myths of humanity, it is universal. It's found among Bushmen, Aborigines, China, the Aztecs, the Mayans.
Yeah,
The Greeks had a flood myth that was actually very much like the one in the Bible.
I mean, there was a flood. I don't know what caused it. Could have been an asteroid strike, a tsunami from an earthquake. It could be anything. Maybe it did rain for 40 days and 40 nights. I don't know, but you're right. Every culture has that story somehow.
Well, there's a scholar at Harvard named E. Michael Witzel who studied this, and he suggested that this story is so ancient that it goes back to the time when the whole human species still lived in Africa. If that's the case, the story becomes a lot more plausible, because if the human race lived in a small part, the whole human race lived in a small part of Africa, there could well have been a flood that nearly wiped everybody else out. It becomes much more plausible from a scientific material point of view.
Right, and geographically.
Geographically. Now, it doesn't tell us why this myth has persisted. One answer is one that I alluded to earlier when talking about Atlantis, which is there have been many such floods, many such destructions of humanity, and in a sense, they, in terms of the past, they all became kind of melded into one. Another aspect of the flood myth, which is almost as universal, not quite as universal, is that the flood is a divine punishment for human sin. In the ancient Sumerian epic, the gods got irritable because there are too many people and they were making too much noise, which I've had neighbors like that. So one idea behind this that can be explored, and people do have a very, very strong visceral feeling that this is the case, that there is a connection between the moral behavior of humanity and the weather, the climate. In Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, when Caesar is about to be murdered, there are all sorts of horrifying portents and storms, and one of the conspirators says to another, whoever knew the heavens menace so? And another one says, those that have known the earth so full of faults. Now, that is also a theme we see in the flood story. The truth of it, well, that's another matter.
I mean, do you really believe that a guy named Noah had been given advance knowledge and a warning of whatever the impending doom was, and he prepared for it?
No. Oh, but I will point out Noah actually means rest in Hebrew. And some have said that it is the flood story is a an allegory of meditation.
All right, but let's assume there was a flood of some origin. What about Genesis that talks about the ark resting, you know, in the mountains of Ararat?
Well, I don't think that that's literally.
You think it's just a story?
Yeah, I mean, mostly. I mean, sometimes the Hebrew words have certain symbolic meanings, which are obviously less clear in the English. RR, I think, remember, is Hebrew for.
Some people claim that they think they found the ark.
Yeah, they do, and you know, who knows what they have found. But I don't think the literal story is true that the human race was wiped out or nearly wiped out 6,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago.
Maybe a region.
Well, yeah. I mean, there were, you know, there have been floods, and some of them are pretty bad. But there may be this notion of this primordial flood way back when that for some reason has lived and persisted in people's memories that, details from later floods were added to.
See, I don't rule out that events like these didn't happen in certain ways. Mm-hmm. I just don't think they happened in those ways, and and it's all subject to interpretation.
Yeah, yeah, and I would, you know, it has always been known, and I will emphasize known, that there are many parts of the Bible that are simply not literally true.
Now you're getting controversial, Richard.
Who is so silly as to imagine that God, like a husbandman, planted a garden in Eden eastward and put in it a tree of life which could be seen and felt? And goes on to say, this is who wrote this? This is the church father Origen, the most learned of all the early church fathers. That was written around, I don't know, 220, 230 AD. That was written by a church father. And he goes on to say, these passages, by means of seeming history, though the incidents never occurred, figuratively reveal certain mysteries. And he said, makes the point that that is also true of the Gospels. What I just said to you is I am reading a literal English translation of what he said. I'm not putting it in my own words.
Now, the subtitle of your book, How God Became God, is interesting. What scholars are really saying about God in the Bible, they don't agree with the biblical text, do they?
No. And, you know, if you want to, you could divide it. Well, if you talk about the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, there's what you could call a magic date of 850 B.C. Now, what happened in 850 B.C.? That is when the Bible really starts to click with the archaeological evidence. And it starts to click with the archaeological evidence in the person of King Ahab of Israel, which did, in the eyes of the Lord, more evil than all the kings of Israel which were before him, mm-hmm. according to the Bible.
Richard, we're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back in a moment, talk more about your work, and we'll also take phone calls in our final hour on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.